ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Felix Velarde. He started one of the world's first digital agencies, and 8 years ago, he founded the 2Y3X program. And the book he wrote about it, Scale at Speed, How to Triple the Size of Your Business and Build a Superstar Team, is now in its second edition. Today, we'll be talking about his book and some of the things that readers can expect to take away and apply to their own businesses. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. It's lovely to be here.
Your book is a great, very complete business growth manual. It talks about selecting and firing talent, pitching clients, value-based pricing, dealing with the unexpected. It's really quite complete, and your writing is very accessible. And Scale at Speed has speed in the title, but in the introduction, you say that most entrepreneurial leaders try to do things too fast. And you mentioned, and I love this, leaders who read things or attend conferences and then lob the change grenades, trying to implement things quickly. So it's in the title, Scale at Speed. How is your approach at managing? How do you sell speed and slow at the same time? How do you balance those two things?
It's a contradiction. And I think that part of it is really about taking a step back. So like most things, more haste, less speed. We have a tendency to get an answer and rush to implement it. And as leaders, part of the reason that we are good leaders is because we understand that any decision is better than no decision. Because if you make a decision and you get it wrong, you can reverse it. But if you don't make a decision, nothing will change.
Right.
And if you want to scale, then it's ingrained in us that, okay, well, I learned something new, let's implement it. And one of the problems with that is that it is very short term. It's very one thing at a time because we have limited bandwidth. Mm-hmm. We aren't as wide ranging and as broad as we think we are. And so we tend to do one thing at a time. And the problem with one thing at a time is you get something right and then you get something wrong and you get something right and you get something wrong. And so you don't really make a huge amount of progress. You make more than you would make if you didn't make any decisions at all. But it doesn't give you the ability to really compound your scaling. That comes from getting other people involved. And so the principle of scale at speed is really not do more things more quickly. It's stop, take stock, get other people involved and do things judiciously. Because if you can get five other people on your team and you can all do things slowly and carefully, you'll get five or six times as many things done than if you do it one at a time yourself.
So one of the things that I gleaned from the book, and I was wondering if it would be fair to say that this anchors your approach, is in some ways you start at the end. You start with your goals and work backwards from those goals to where you are today. So you're making bite-sized pieces of it. Is that a fair,
one of the problems, again, is that is a tendency. And it's a perfectly natural tendency. If we want to go forward, we look down at where our feet are and we make sure that we've got sure footing and we take one step. And we can have all the ambition in the world, but we still look at where we are and start saying, okay, where can I go from here? Now, that's very different to, I want to be at the top of that mountain I can see over there. How do I get there?
You still work backwards, right? You don't say, I want to get to that mountain. My feet are here. I will point them toward the mountain. Instead, you're sort of saying halfway to the mountain, I would be here. And then if I back up again, three quarters of the way,
The world's biggest retailer is or used to be Tesco. And their strategic approach was called man on a high mountain. And the approach was in 5 years' time, you're standing on top of the mountain. Now look back to where you started and figure out what path you took to get where you are now.
Right.
And as a strategic framework, that's very clever. Mm-hmm. Because it basically says, you can see the top of the mountain. If you just start going, you have no idea where the route that you are trying to take will actually lead you. You don't know whether it'll take you to the top of the mountain or to a dead end or to a stream or turn you around and make you go around the mountain. If you start at the top and you look backwards and figure out what the journey must have been, then it's very easy to write all that down. Click your fingers or tap your heels and magic yourself back to the beginning and follow the path that you wrote with kind of hindsight, pre-hindsight. Mm-hmm. So that approach of setting what Jim Collins called big, hairy, audacious goals, really ambitious things, and saying, how, if I achieve this, how would I have gotten here? Because then you can write a path down. And that's the general approach of 2Y3X and the scale at speed methodology, is to say, let's set some really ambitious goals and figure out what must have been true to have gotten us here.
Right.
So we picture ourselves at the end of 3 years and we say, okay, we have achieved our grandest dreams. We've sold our company for squillions and we've achieved a 99% net promoter score and we are top of the tree in our industry. What on earth did we do that got us here? And then you can figure out what the major milestones must have been. And
I have a series of questions on all this, and before I don't want to lose them. First off, how far of a time horizon? You've tossed out Tesco's, you said 5 years. Earlier in the conversation, you said 3 years. What's the time horizon that you recommend people think about?
Yeah, Unilever uses 15 years and 25 years as their time horizons. The book is aimed really at relatively small businesses.
Right.
And the ones that have come through the program successfully are all within, I don't know, 2 million to 10 or 12 million in sales, annual sales. So as small businesses, we know that staff turnover is going to be relatively high. It's not people come here for 10-year careers. So 3 years is the horizon that we use. And 3 years, the reason for that is that 3 years is far enough away that whatever goal you set, you've got enough breathing space to be able to get there. And it's probably not very intimidating. But it's not so far that you can defer action. It's not so far that the world will have changed in 5 years' time. I mean, COVID.
That's part two of that question. Mm. In a world where there is constant change, where the landscape, you have some exponential external factors that are changing so rapidly, the impact of generative AI, which is in the hockey stick inflection point right now, and it will revolutionize many, many industries. A number of CEOs I've talked to, they say, well, I can't have long-term plans. It just is too changeable. Do you still think it's 3 years? And then are you readjusting each year? How do you...
And when a crisis comes along,
okay,
the framework has the flexibility to accommodate it. And when COVID hit, and it really hit hard, all of our clients, everybody who's doing Scale at Speed and going through the program.
It hit everybody pretty hard, The universe was hit pretty hard.
But one of the things that was very interesting was that part of Scale at Speed is understanding risks and risk mitigation. And one of the first things that we address, both in the book and in the program and in the work that we do, is listing every single risk and figuring out what we would have to do if that risk were to come true. And then we prioritize those risks. And then we prioritize based on likelihood and severity and fatality, if you like, this existential threat of those risks, what to do about those risks. So every single client that we were working with when the pandemic hit had already got a risk register that had an item in it that said, what would we do if we couldn't get into work? What would we do if the world shut down for 3 months?
Right.
And so most of the people in the program were very well prepared. I mean, it was still a shock and it was still required everybody to roll their sleeves up and pedal really hard. But some of the people in the program had their most profitable month ever, most profitable quarter ever during the pandemic, because they were to some degree prepared for it. Now we've got AI, which frankly we've known about for the last 5 years or 6 years as being coming up. Gartner's hype cycle has been listing it for yonks, technical term. And we've known it's on the horizon. Now, most of the people who go through the 2Y3X program, they're marketing agencies of one sort or another. They are going to be decimated.
It's
going to
be, yeah, I have an interview with a academic who using off-the-shelf Gen AI, giving marketing goal prompts, was able to generate advertising that beats the existing advertising.
Yeah,
just and marketing and, goal yeah. prompts. And so it will revolutionize. It will revolutionize in a really disruptive fashion. And I think it'll happen. You're right. It's been coming up for a while.
But it's like e-commerce. It's
slow and then it's fast. It's like the way people go bankrupt, you know?
I mean, I started one of the world's first web design companies in 1994. And we knew what was coming up. We knew that that all of a sudden Greenpeace UK could speak real time to Greenpeace USA and coordinate stuff. And we helped them do it. Yeah, we knew that politics was going to change and that globalization was going to happen. We knew all of this in the very early 90s, late 80s. And so we were just waiting for it to happen. Now, we've been addressing AI in agencies now for the last year and a half, seriously. We now have modules built into 2Y3X about how do you do the critical thinking required so that you can adapt to your agency or your consultancy or whatever it is that you do to the opportunities around AI. How do you do the critical thinking around what do you do about headcount? Because one of the problems with the sort of superficial thinking about AI is, hey, we can reduce costs and we can reduce headcount. Well, if you do that, you remove progression to expertise, for example.
Well, this is you've just actually hit on exactly one of the things that I keep talking to people about, which is right now we have a population where there are experts because people had entry-level jobs and worked their way up and had experience. And if you cut out all this connective tissue, you're going to create a problem down the road.
But there's an even more fundamental problem, which was articulated by Henry Ford, which was, I want to pay my worker enough that they can buy a car from me. And if we fire everybody and replace them with AI to do the marketing, they're marketing to people who can no longer afford to buy the products we're marketing.
Well, you need to read Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff, which tackles exactly the shift of that. But that's a whole nother conversation.
We can get into exponential as well.
But getting back on track, the other question I had is the big, hairy, audacious goals. How granular should goals be? How many should there be? Mm-hmm. Do you bucket the goals into people, customers?
Well, you're talking about the way that we actually make it easy for people to enact and implement the framework that's described in Scale at Speed. But if we say, okay, let's start at the end with big, hairy, audacious goals. There's a scientist called Dr. Edwin Locke, who for the last 45 years or so he came up with a thing called goal setting theory. And more or less it says, the grander the goal, the more ambitious the goal, the more likely you are to succeed. And he's scientifically validated this 4,000 ways from next Tuesday. And one of the reasons for this is the grander the goal, the more likely you are to have to put a plan together. And if you put a plan together and you follow it, then you're more likely to achieve the goal. And if you don't have a plan, then you're kind of whistling in the wind. And so if you combine big, hairy, audacious goals and goal setting theory with a 3-year horizon, then it's just about, okay, what goals do we need to set? Now, as founders and owners of businesses, we tend to have a financial goal in mind. We want an exit, or we want to be able to retire and go and address the Great Pacific garbage patch or something like that. Or we want to expand globally, and we have ambitions. So there's always a financial goal. And the financial goal keeps everybody focused. This is about business. Keeps everybody focused on a grand number. And that grand number might be, how much do you want to sell your company for? Or at what point do we want to give all of the shares in our company to all of our employees, for example, which is great. So that's one goal. But the problem with just setting a financial goal is there are many, many easier ways of making large amounts of money than running a good company.
Ha ha, this is true.
Yes. And so when you get people who are just focused on the money, venality comes in and scruples and morals tend to go out of the window.
So that book is for a different book for those folks. Not
a different book for those folks. I'm a passionate believer that the only thing that you really need to get right in a business is understanding your core values and the core values of the people around you. And I don't mean the crap that you see on people's websites about the customer always comes first. I mean the stuff that says I'm going to be loyal or we are honorable. That stuff is the stuff that counts. And so there needs to be a culture goal in there as well. And so we'll use a culture goal that might be a proxy of we want all of our employees to own the company, or we want employee satisfaction scores to be 97% across the whole organization by the end of year three, consistently for 6 months, which is great. Now, that's going to drive a whole bunch of behaviors around what kind of culture you have. Right. And then that's going to attract amazing people. Amazing people do better work. They're happier. They perform better financially. Right. So this all wraps up. And then finally, we have a quality of service goal. What do we do for a living as a business? Are we the best law firm in Atlanta, or are we the best digital agency on the planet, or are we the most creative thinkers in I don't know what? Right.
Right. Right.
But we set these three goals so that each of those goals holds the other two goals to account.
Right.
So that we don't go off the rails and become just focused on how lovey-dovey it is here and wonderful and become not profit-making at all. I mean, that might be a goal, by the way. But it needs to be stated as a goal so everybody knows what we're doing. And the reason that we fix these three goals is so that we can then plan backwards. So going back to the beginning of our conversation, if you start at the end and you say, okay, we're going to be the number one in our niche, we're going to be making this amount of profit, and our employee satisfaction is going to be off the charts. What do we need to do? Well, we need a training academy so that we can do better work. We need brilliant sales and PR about our proposition. Our proposition needs to be crystal clear. And suddenly you're starting to think about things that you need to do in order to achieve these goals or in order to have achieved these goals by the end of year three.
Can I jump in a little bit here, which is, okay, a lot of these goals, strategic goals, and then there's the planning. And can you talk just a little bit about the difference between strategy and planning?
Yeah. Strategy is what do we want to achieve? And planning is how do we achieve it? How are we going to do it?
Okay. All right. So now then the other piece is we have this longer term strategic goal, and we're the man on the mountain, the person on the mountain.
The human on the mountain.
Yes. Definitely not the generative AI on the mountain. But anyway, we have these strategic goals, and then we work backward. But the knitting together of the longer term strategic goal with the day to day, I need to pay everybody. The I'm in a boat, but I want it to be an airplane, but I can't sink my boat problem, if you will. That's where I've seen things and very well intentioned companies struggle and stumble. So
yeah.
How do you
a winged flight. Yeah.
Right. So knitting it together where things don't meet up, how do you solve for that?
So it's a really, really good question, because it's one that most management and growth kind of handbooks don't address. The fact is you've got a business right now that is more or less successful. And one of the reasons it's very difficult to scale businesses that are successful is because you optimize for the successful business that you are today. And yet, if you want to be three times bigger, you need to optimize for the business you're going to be tomorrow. And you can't do that, those two things at the same time with the same team. And so there's a separation that's required. And the thing that we found was that if we task the senior management team, the current leadership team, with keeping the wheels on and the machine working with the systems and processes that they've designed to deliver great work for the customers that expect great products and services, then that business, today's business, carries on going. And that's great. So now we need a new team to design and build tomorrow's business.
Right.
And so that's where the Growth Lab team comes in. A Growth Lab team essentially is us finding superstars of the future from within the business, not the leaders, but the superstars of the future. And we say to them, we're going to put you in a room and we're going to envision three goals in 3 years' time. We're going to envision this brand new agency that's come out of the what we've got today, but we're going to imagine what this 3 years on agency looks like. What does it look like? What are we going to have to do? What are we going to have to change? What new things are we going to have to implement for us to be that new 3 years hence agency?
So a question, because you talked about the size of the companies you're dealing with, 2 million, 12 million, certainly at a 2 million company, if that's your turnover, then you oftentimes have founder CEOs and how that's a challenging thing. This is their thing that they have bootstrapped. The surrender of the future to when it's their baby is challenging. So it seems to me that some leaders, there are qualities that make this possible. And there are some leaders who simply, that a lot of your work as a consultant, coach, teacher for these folks is getting them to allow it to happen.
And I'll make a confession. I don't think that I or many other people are capable of making the argument in a convincing enough way to persuade people who don't already believe they need outside help to actually go down this path. I think one of the things that we've observed as a consulting firm with clients all over the world is that you have, as a founder, as a leader, to have realized that you can't do this on your own and realized that there's only so many times that you can bump up against this growth ceiling or the growth plateau before you seek outside expertise to say, actually, this is how you break through the growth ceiling or the growth plateau.
How do you sell that person? Okay, I'm a person, I'm a CEO, and I am bumping up on that ceiling and I say, I definitely need outside help. And you come in and you say, yes, and here's the plan. Your stars of tomorrow are going to be on this team and you are not on the team. And the guy says, not so fast.
We cheat.
Okay.
We put the founder on the team.
Okay. That's what I wanted to hear because I can't see the founder not being on the team.
No, we put the founder on the team.
Okay.
And often we'll put one other member of the senior management team on the team. And the reason for that is to make sure that there's implicit permission for the Growth Lab team to get on with the stuff that they need to do.
And to also free up barriers and things, I imagine.
Yeah, completely. They've got to open the doors. Now, the argument is really simple. The argument is your bandwidth, Mrs. Founder, is one person, albeit one brilliant person. And obviously you've got three times the brains of everybody else in the business and it's your vision. So you'll work 25 hours a day, but you only have one you. Now there are going to be six of you or five of you. Isn't that going to be amazing? So, and here's a sort of a sidebar, if you like. When I was a founder and an agency CEO, which I was five or six times, and then I was an agency group CEO, and now I'm a group head of strategy at an M&A company and stuff. I was always taught that delegation was the key. And the reality is that delegation doesn't solve the your bandwidth problem. All it does is get other people to do the work. You still have to pass every decision and review every single thing and all the work that's got to be done. You are still the bandwidth problem.
It's actually handing it over. It's not becoming that bottleneck. It's surrendering.
This is surrendering and sitting in a room and saying, there are five of us. One of you is going to go off and come up with a solution for, I don't know, a client satisfaction survey, a customer satisfaction survey. And in a month's time, you're going to come back and say, I did this research. And this is what best practice, and this is what I think is going to work for us. I'm going to prototype it next month. And then next month you come back and say, we prototyped it and this bit worked and this bit didn't. This is what we're going to implement. And the third month, the end of the first quarter, you say, this is what we implemented. We now do a customer satisfaction survey. Now, that doesn't require delegation. It requires a group of people holding each other to account to do the critical thinking and the research and the prototyping in such a way that the solution works. And if it doesn't pass the prototype, it doesn't get implemented. So in fact, change, which happens on a quarterly basis, where five or six changes happen every quarter, only happens when things have been de-risked. So it's actually a very low-risk way of changing, if you like, the wing in flight, little bit by little bit.
Sorry. I can't imagine that your client, I mean, and I'm pushing at this because I work with senior leaders and change is uncomfortable. It's really uncomfortable. And the more important the change is, it's a very uncomfortable thing. And it has to be, to your point, something that people themselves are ready to do, that they have to be ready to change in order to do that. So if you have somebody who has become very successful, smartest person in the room, and they have engaged you and you and they understand intellectually the not only I'm not delegating, I am empowering ownership of this thing. Yes. No, this piece of this work is not my baby anymore. It's in service of my baby, but it's their baby and they own it. And
oh my goodness,
I don't control.
What a relief.
Well, how, so do they feel? I mean, I imagine that you have to work a lot with that person.
No, not at all.
Really? Really?
Really, really interesting, because what happens is, once they get the theory, and the theory is very easy to buy, right? The theory is when you as the leader, when you delegate stuff and you ask people to change with these change grenades that you mentioned at the beginning, people resist change. People in your company always resist change. They resist change because it works fine. And they don't care whether your ambition is to sell the company in 3 years' time for 10 times more than it's worth now. They don't care that. They just want to do their job and not screw up. So they resist change. Now, if you get them to design the change, that resistance evaporates.
Right.
And within 3 months, as the founder, owner, leader, whatever your job title is, you see other people taking stuff on and running with it. That never happens when you're telling people what to do.
Right. If you have a team of waiters versus a kitchen of with chefs, this is.
And our job, as we know, is to empower people and get out of the way. And yet we don't do it because we never see people really taking ownership. This is extreme ownership. This is ownership by the superstars in the business, the A players, the genuinely engaged, right? The people who can really think, that really make stuff happen, who are really creative and thoughtful, and the people who all the superstars in, are in your business. Those people coming up with great ideas that you wouldn't have come up with yourself is a relief. And by the time you start seeing these things becoming and actually becoming inculcated in your company and the change is starting to happen little bit by little bit, it's a relief. And as a founder and an owner, when I check in with people after 6 months or so, after the first two quarters, and they see the changes that have happened in the business over the last 6 months, it's revolutionary.
Well, and then they're on board. Then I can see how they're on board. It's the first few.
So that's why it's a 2-year program.
Right. Well, so last question to wrap things up. Marketing is included with sales as one of your 5 core business subject areas. And it's refreshing for a function that has sometimes been thought of as brand or advertising part of the business that you see marketing as part of the scaling conversation. So two-part question to close out our conversation. How do you differentiate marketing from sales, and how do you see marketing's role in the growth agenda?
So I don't really differentiate between marketing and sales. It's a spectrum, and at a certain point, it flips from one to obviously the other. I think it's very difficult to do sales without a fantastic, very clear proposition. 2Y3X's proposition is written into its name. It's 2 years, 3X value, right? As you go to our website, the proposition sings. A great proposition directs your people. It directs your customers in terms of their expectation. And it allows you to take people on a journey which starts with, I think I need to break through this growth barrier and triple my value so that I can exit. Let's start a conversation. Where would I find this? Do I go to Google and look it up? To a sales process. And if the clients and customers are self-selecting, self-electing, the sales process becomes facilitative rather than manipulative, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So I think that it is a continuum. And I think that marketing really starts with proposition, clear, crystal clear proposition that every single person in the company can repeat, that doesn't take anybody much understanding. It doesn't require sophistication. It's does what it says on the tin, because if you can do that, then everything else is easy. The marketing is easy. The sales is easy. And where we do sales enablement, it's basically saying, let's sort out your proposition first, then let's sort out how you take that proposition and teach people what that really means. And how do you then leverage that to get customers coming to you?
Right.
Because that's all that's really required. And that doesn't matter whether you're a brand new startup with two employees or you're a 200 million corporation.
Right. Well, perfect. What a nice way to round things out. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's a really great resource. Everybody should pick up the book. And I said in the opening, it is in its second edition. So please grab a copy. There is a link to purchase on the show notes.
Thank you, Gabriella. It's magic.
We've reached the end of another episode. Up Next, I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.